Mr. Trunkle. Where's heaven?
All right, friends, Greg Kogel here back with you live and lively. I missed you last week, but I'm glad to be with you this week. I've been kind of globe-hopping a little bit. It's kind of nice to be sitting in one place for a little while that isn't on an airplane. The show, of course, is Stand to Reason, where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed right here in the open form of talk radio, and usually we open the lines for you, and we will be doing that. In hour number two, just a reminder, we're on shortened schedule now, so at least some of our markets will be, that being the Southern California market, shut down 20 minutes early, but the rest of you listening will have more material after that. So you just I'll clue you in on how that works in the second hour. The first hour, I want to talk to someone who is actually new to Stand to Reason, but I've heard his name before, and he's done a lot of significant work outside of the field of what might be considered Christian apologetics, but has stepped into that with a force, with a book that is meant to be a broadside at the what has come to be called the New Atheists, and the Richard Dawkins, the Daniel Dennett's, the Sam Harris's, the Christopher Hitchens, who have made a big splash. This man is also making a big splash, taking them on head-to-head with a new book, What's So Great About Christianity. He's a New York Times best-selling author, a fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, author of What's So Great About America, and that's his New York Times bestseller, and a whole bunch of other things we'll probably get to shortly. His name is Dinesh D'Souza, and Dinesh, I'm glad to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Nice to be on the show.
I'm surprised, actually. Our paths haven't crossed sooner. Because from what I can tell, we have a like-minded way of addressing the challenge of being Christian ambassadors, given the particular challenges of 21st century.
Well, I've read some of your articles, and so our paths have crossed, you may say, online.
In a certain sense, huh?
You know, I've been a secular writer for 15 years and written 7 books about issues of culture, foreign policy, markets, and so on. Mm-hmm. This is my first book that's directly about Christianity. Mm-hmm. In some of my earlier books, values, issues, and Christianity is an undercurrent of my work, but it wasn't explicit. Mm-hmm. So I began this book a little modestly to do a book on how Christianity has formed America and the West, but then one by one I saw these atheist books coming out, and I realized there was really a two-fisted, very comprehensive assault being made against Christianity, one mm-hmm. that really required a different kind of answer than I was starting to write. So I widened the scope of the book, and now it's I think, a full-throated defense mm-hmm. of Christianity and an answer to the new atheist.
Well, it is full-throated, that's for sure. There's a lot that you cover here, in part because there's a lot that's being covered by the other guys. You know, I mentioned just a handful, probably the most prominent names, but there are more than those that are weighing in now. And sometimes their arguments kind of cross. In other words, they're similar arguments, and others they have the unique kind of twist to them. So all told, these guys are a significant force to deal with in the culture.
I count about a dozen books. There's Victor Stenger, the physicist, has one. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, has
right.
Breaking the Spell.
Right.
And I think you now have these new atheist websites. There's a new atheist radio show that's in the works for Air America. So mm-hmm. we're seeing a new phenomenon. We've always had unbelievers.
Right.
But a generation ago, the poster child for atheism was Madeleine Murray O'Hare or
right.
some rumpled ACLU attorney.
Right.
But the new atheists, you know, they come out of the universities. They're sophisticated, like Christopher Hitchens. They're witty. Mm-hmm. They're stylish, and so I think that they are appealing to a generation of young people in a way that didn't occur before.
Yeah, and they have an attitude too, you know, and they're not going to be pushed down. What's surprised me a little bit, Dinesh, and I'm not sure how you followed the philosophical development with regards to Christianity and that in the last 10 or 15 years, but I'd say within the last 20 years, the biggest threat has been really coming from the what might be called postmodern side of the ledger. And here, kind of blindsiding a whole bunch of us, the modernists, the Enlightenment guys, are kind of making a new assault. And so it's almost like a two-front war that people like myself, who have been defending Christianity in the public square for quite a while, find ourselves in.
The post postmodern stuff, you know, has a niche in the universities, but honestly, I don't think it has broad appeal. Hmm. On the other hand, if you go to a young guy who's heading off to college, particularly the smart young Christian, you know, it's very attractive to believe, listen, don't believe anything if you don't have tangible evidence for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the scientific point of view, which has vindicated itself so powerfully in our own time, computers, cell phones, iPods, and so on, gives people a reliable leg to stand on. What is also new is that the Enlightenment atheists, as you call them, have very smartly grabbed the mantle of morality.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just saying we are the reasonable guys. They're saying we are the moral guys. Christianity is immoral. Look at the way in which it it bears resemblances to Islamic radicalism.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the way in which it has caused the Inquisition, the religious wars, the witch trials, and so on. So there's an effort here to portray the atheist as a peaceful, decent, reasonable guy, and the Christian as a fanatical, crazy, irrational guy.
Yeah, I count December 11th as the kind of the time when the culture began to shift that made September 11, 2001, as the time that the culture became much more open to this way of approaching things. I don't know if you read Thomas Friedman's article that was written just after the attack, where he identified the real problem here as what he called religious totalitarianism. The article is called "The Real Enemy," and basically said anybody who believes their religion is right is the one that's the dangerous person. And we have still at that time the towers were still smoking, you know, or what used to be the towers.
Right.
That smoke was still rising, and it seemed like a lot of these people have kind of picked up on that theme and now are capitalizing on it. They're riding along with it, not just the postmodern types but the modernist types, with this point that you're saying, and not only are Christians wrong, but they're evil too.
One of the atheists after 9/11 very craftily described 9/11 as, quote, a faith-based initiative.
Yeah, I heard that rhetoric.
I think, you know, to be honest, the atheists have been riding the coattails of 9/11, but when you get them up against the wall, when you're debating them, you find that you can challenge them. Say, wait a minute, you know, yes, it's true the Islamic radicals do what they do in the name of God, but there's nothing equivalent on the Christian side, certainly not today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where's the regime today that is run on the Christian side that would resemble the Ayatollah's Iran?
Well,
who's the Christian bin Laden?
So, right. Well, I was with I did a one-on-one or a head-to-head with Gary Wills, the Pulitzer Prize winner and emeritus professor of history from Northwestern University, 2 weeks ago on NPR, and he shifted that right onto the Bush administration. I mean, it was a pretty ridiculous thing, but it's not just him, but people like Andrew Sullivan, you know, in this Time magazine article last fall, when not seeing is believing, and he equates Bush to a Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, you know, as people who think their religion is right and therefore are a threat to the world, and Bush because he's an evangelical Christian. So it seems like this is where they're picking up their kind of fodder, if you will, even though I agree with you, Dinesh, they are worlds apart when you look at the particulars.
The worlds apart, and really for the past 3 years, the attack on Bush has basically been aimed at the so-called neoconservatives, who are mainly Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea has been here that the neocons have been sort of have been running the foreign policy, and Bush has been, if you will, an unwilling sort of acquiescer.
Really? So you think that the beef is with the neocons that are Jews and not with the religious right that seem to be steering him? I mean, that isn't the way Andrew Sullivan
Right. Now, Andrew Sullivan, of course, no, I agree with you. Well, he has a book basically saying that doubt is good, doubt is a virtue in and of itself.
Yeah, that was his answer.
To pursue what is true.
Yeah.
No, and I think here's where you have to hit back really hard and say, wait a minute, you know, if you're claiming that moral certainty produces these terrible deeds, you know, then what about the atheist regimes of the 20th century?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those guys didn't believe in God. They didn't believe in absolutes. Mm-hmm. And they killed far more people, frankly, on a good afternoon than the Inquisition killed in two centuries.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, so here we have, on the other side of it, Dostoevsky's idea that if God does not exist, everything is permitted.
Mm-hmm.
And so atheists have found that without the concept of ultimate moral accountability, there's incredible license to kill just as many people as you want if you have the power and if it's in your interest to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, my brother Dave called me the other day, and he heard my Gary Wills put me to task about whether the founding fathers of this country were really Christian and whether they were deists. He said deists. As you know, he's dead wrong in this, but my brother heard my broadcast just after that event and then saw you on Hannity and Combe. Hennedy Combs maybe the next day or something. And he said he was quite impressed. He says, you ever hear this Dinesh D'Souza guy? And I said, yeah, I've heard of him. I'm going to be interviewing on Sunday shortly. But because he said he must have been reading your stuff because he said exactly the same thing that you did in on your show. And I said, no, I don't think he read my stuff. I think he just read the stuff, the primary source documentation that's available to everybody on this. But it seemed like you handled those guys pretty well.
Well, the thing is, remember, I've been debating in the public circuit on political topics for a long time, and one of my earlier books was on civil rights. It actually looked at why non-white immigrants in America do pretty well, mm-hmm. African Americans less well. So I've debated people like Jesse Jackson, Cornel West, a lot of the strongest debaters in the country. I'm just coming new to this topic, mm-hmm. and so Hitchens, for example, has been marching around the country. He's had a lot of debates, but I had a big one with him in New York about 2 weeks ago.
I did hear about that. That's available on like YouTube or something, is that right?
Right. C-SPAN broadcasts it, and you can buy the video from them, but it's online. It's actually on my website, DineshDeSouza.com, which I'll spell, if you don't mind, DineshDeSouza.com. Mm-hmm. I think your listeners will enjoy it. And I don't go on the defensive. A lot of people, in some ways, the Christians are too nice. We turn the other cheek a little too much mm-hmm. in these situations. Mm-hmm. But my approach is very much to administer Hitchens a long-deserved horsewhipping. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very combative
in the most thing. Christian way possible, right?
Well, you can be nice at the end.
No, well, I think sometimes pastors get in the fray here and they just don't have the I don't want to say killer instinct because that's not really what I mean, but they don't have the wisdom that is necessary to maneuver properly in that kind of environment. It takes something different than talking about these same things, to your congregation. It takes
exactly.
a different kinds of edginess, but it doesn't require that you be, a jerk in the process, and that's sometimes a tough balance to maintain.
We once lived in a
especially
culture
when the other guy is being a jerk to you, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, we once lived in a culture where Christian assumptions were taken for granted, where you could settle an argument by saying, here's what the Bible says.
Right.
The book of Leviticus says this about homosexuality. Mm-hmm. But now the guy will say to you, hey, I don't care what the book of Leviticus says. I don't accept the authority of the Bible to adjudicate the mm-hmm. matter. And suddenly you realize that you need to give secular arguments. You
right.
need reason and evidence and science, the same tools that the atheists appeal
right.
to.
Right. And plus the book of Leviticus says that we should execute homosexuals, and they're often quick to point that out. And so a lot of people aren't quick enough on their feet or have the knowledge base to be able to explain why things are different now than they were then and all that other stuff. So you're right. You have an accent, which means that you're from some other country. And I know a little bit about your background, but I think our listeners might like to know what that is, that kind of the history for you and your family and becoming a Christian. You make mention of that in your book, What's So Great About Christianity. Why don't you tell us a little bit about
that?
Well,
I was born in Bombay, India, in a part of India called Goa, which used to be a Portuguese colony for centuries. The Portuguese sent over the Portuguese Inquisition about four centuries ago, mm-hmm. And all our families became Catholic. Mm-hmm. Now, some people say, well, that was terrible. They all used force and bayonets and so on, and it was terrible in a way. But the good news is actually a lot of Hindus in India rushed to become Christians. And why? Because they were members of the lower castes within Hinduism. Mm-hmm. They were the untouchables, the Dalits, the low caste. And if you're a low caste Hindu, you cannot get out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how hard you work. And your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are condemned to the same caste.
The only way out is death.
The only way out is death. Yeah. And then your progeny don't escape either.
Yeah,
So these Hindus said, wait a minute, if I can go into Christianity, right away I'm a Christian brother, right away there's the doctrine of equality in the mm-hmm. eyes of God. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Hindus fled out of Hinduism into the arms of the missionaries. But look, what often happens with us, and I came to America at the age of 16, I went to Dartmouth College, and of course I had learned Christianity as a child, but it was a childlike version of Christianity. So when I went off to college, I realized I was bombarded with skeptical questions. Hey, how can you believe in miracles in the 20s? Or the 21st century, mm-hmm. don't you believe that the world operates according to invariant laws? Mm-hmm. Are you telling me some guy can walk on the ocean or change water into wine? And so I found my childhood Christianity battered, and I found it difficult to defend it. And so I can see what happens to a lot of young people today. So what we need to do is go back and fortify, if you will, that childhood Christianity with an adult, mature, intelligent Christianity that can meet the objections that are flung our way. And so this book has been a real journey for me in a way, because it's been an attempt, it's been a way of fortifying my faith and also being able to present it. And I've got a 12-year-old daughter. I know she's going to go out in the world. I know what she's in for. Mm-hmm. And so this is a way that I can equip her to meet what will surely come her way.
Yeah. Now, you principally, I mean, your title is What's So Great About Christianity. Now, in a sense, you're playing off of your earlier title, What's So Great About America, and I'm not sure if that book came out before Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great, but this title now sounds like your old title, but it also sounds like a, you know, in-your-face to Hitchens, because there's a similarity there, you know, God Is Not Great, how religion poisons everything. Was that an accident?
Well, when I wrote What's So Great About America shortly after 9/11, and I like the double sort of entendre of the title, because it sort of can be read either way.
Yes,
obviously, I meant it as What's So Great About America! Exclamation point.
I'll tell you. You know.
But you could go, you know, What's So Great About America?
Right.
And so it has the mode of being an inquiry as well as a rational defense.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized the title will work well in this subject. I didn't want to make it just seem like a book in which I'm just saying, hurrah, hurrah, hurrah,
mm-hmm.
but rather taking on seriously the question raised by the atheist.
Mm-hmm.
I try to show, for example, that there is nothing inconsistent in modern science with proclaiming the possibility of miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And I do it by looking at the philosopher David Hume's favorite argument, or famous argument, against miracles.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I like the fact that it sort of seems to play up against the Hitchens book, and really all these books are taken together, because they're very common themes in the new atheism.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these books are materialist. They deny any non-material reality, including including the non-material existence of God. And many of them lean on Darwinism. They basically say Darwin has shown us you can have design without a designer,
mm-hmm.
and therefore the traditional argument from design.
The blind watchmaker,
is
for example.
The blind watchmaker. So mm-hmm. this is the atheism of our time, and mm-hmm. we should be ready to combat it.
Well, when we come back from our break, and we're jumping just in a little bit early here to our break, because this is a nice little pause for us, I want to get into some of those particular issues. Now, you mentioned Darwinism, and I will tell you, Dinesh, I was not really excited about all that you said about Darwinism, so I'm going to raise up some questions for you, and I'm interested in your response about that, but I don't want to spend the whole time talking about that. You get into some of the philosophical issues. I want to know about your treatment of miracles. I think a lot of the challenge has to do to Christianity by the new atheists is that Christianity is evil, which is odd because some of these people are atheists, and so one can question, well, what is your grounding for your understanding of morality to begin with? And that's another issue. And so there are a lot of places we can go here and talk a little bit about the way that you deal with some of the kinds of challenges that the new atheists have offered. And the book is What's So Great About Christianity? And the author is a New York Times best-selling author, Dinesh D'Souza. His first venture really into this enterprise, and in particular defending Christianity, and he's done a noble effort, I think, here. And we'll talk about a number of those things when we return at Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2nd, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, B.C. for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit STR.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from str.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and that was such good good entry music. I hadn't heard that before. I'm thinking, all right, I like that. Great. We're talking about Dinesh D'Souza's new book, What's So Great About Christianity, and we're talking with Dinesh himself because it's about time that our guys start firing significant, not just shots over the bow, but shots into the bow of the new atheists who've been writing like crazy the last couple of years and having, I think, a very powerful impact on the population in general, and I think even on Christians who pick this stuff up and then get shaken up really badly. Have you noticed that, Dinesh?
Absolutely. I think that really for the first time, perhaps in our lifetime, atheism is being seen as a serious option. In other words, people may not believe before, but the idea of coming out at a dinner party and saying, you know, I'm an atheist, yeah, so what?
Right.
You know, I feel, and preening about it, feeling that I have not only intellect, but, you know, morality on my side. This is
right.
New.
Right, right. And it reminds me of Dawkins's comment that that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually satisfied atheist, you know, and then this is coming home to roost right now. These guys, like, I think the word you used just a moment ago was preening. Before we go into Darwinism, though, because you actually, well, we'll get to that in a minute. I want to point out that your very first two entries in your book is first a note on interpretation of Scripture, and my sense after reading that, I mean, I did a little hooray, great, I wrote there the title, because not only do you take what appears to be a high view of Scripture, consistent with what most of my listeners probably would view it, but you also champion a straightforward reading of the Scripture. In other words, you take it in its plain sense. And so if something extraordinary seems to be described as an historical event, we shouldn't just kind of make it into some kind of a story just because this is an embarrassment to moderns.
Right.
Miracles like
that
happen.
I mean, I've been amazed to see the way in which some liberal theologians run from the idea of miracles and come up with comical things like, oh, Jesus, well, you know, when he walked on the ocean, there must have been an underground platform holding him up.
Yeah, or a sandbar.
You know, that's right. Or when he changed the loaves and fishes into food, there must have been packed lunches around there somewhere.
Yeah, the little boy. Right, right. It's
and
just,
look, you know, ours is a faith that depends upon at least the central miracle of the resurrection.
Right.
So, look, you can't dodge these things. And I was an English major at Dartmouth, and I know in literature there are multiple styles of literary interpretation.
Genre.
You know, and I tried to bring that complexity to bear on Scripture and say, listen, Scripture operates at multiple levels, and in fact, multiple levels simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the book of Exodus, it was read as a literal account of what happened to the Jews as they left Egypt, and a sort of spiritual tale of liberation. So
mm-hmm.
black slaves would sing songs out of Exodus,
right,
go
right.
down Moses, and so on, in the dark night of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
You see the beauty of Scripture operating here at multiple levels, and in a way, to me, the atheist, in a way, imitates, you know, the most ignorant fundamentalist, in the sense that the atheist basically takes the words almost as if you just learned English,
yeah,
you know, and
right.
I got to read them in the stupidest way possible, and then makes us defend those things.
Well, so, unfortunately, there are Christians who do that, though, and they find those guys, and then they hitchhike on their silly, you know, God said it, I believe it, that settles
it. You've got simple Christians who do that, but these atheists are educated people.
Right.
They should
know
better. They come out of the best universities in the world.
I'm with you on that. And so it's a little disingenuousness coming from them. And then the second chapter is a challenge, or the second thing you wrote is actually the preface, a challenge to believers and unbelievers. And basically you tell believers, hey, don't be afraid, come out of the closet, let's give these guys a fair fight because we can win. And they
a lot of Christians have been hanging back and thinking, you know, look, I'll practice my faith in private, in church, at home. I'll let the public square stay neutral. And that's why I think you use the term blindsided. Suddenly these atheists have come galloping in. They've occupied the public square.
Mm-hmm.
They've declared their intention to take over the education system. Some of them even call parental teaching of religion to young people a form of child abuse.
Right, right.
And they say, if you're programming your children with religion, our job in the universities is to deep deprogram them, take the religion out of them, teach them skepticism. So there's a real battle here that's been declared by the other side. Mm-hmm. We really can't just sit this one out on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about how that is the strategy. We're gonna take your kids and we're going to turn the children against the parents in terms of religion. They're going to use higher education and lower education, actually, the educational system to do this, and they've actually been using that very, very well. But you actually think that Twilight, rather atheism, is in the twilight and global Christianity is triumphing. In other words, theirs is a losing cause and ours is a victorious cause. And you look at the way people wouldn't say that here in the United States. Christians wouldn't say that we're winning and they're losing.
Well, worldwide, that is most emphatically the case, and that is that if you look around the world, you know, many of these atheists, if you go back to scholarship 10 or 20 years, the prevailing idea was that as the world becomes more modern, more technological, more affluent, more educated, religion can be expected to wither away. Mm-hmm. And this has not happened. In fact, we have seen a religious boom. We've seen it in Islam. We've seen it in Hinduism. Many people don't realize that Christianity is, in fact, the fastest-growing religion in the world.
Mm-hmm.
People would often say it's Islam, but no, Islam is the second fastest.
Mm-hmm.
And so the atheists have suddenly realized, wait a minute, we can't just sit around and wait for religion to go away. It's not going to go away. We have to mount a powerful attack against it. Now, we're not the majority, but we are very powerfully ensconced in the universities, in the media. Look at the free ride that these atheists have had for 3 years in the national media.
In the academy, right. Yeah,
you know,
in the academy.
People are just genuflecting before them, mm-hmm, and giving no counter-arguments, even
right,
when they make the most preposterous assertions.
Right.
Here, Christopher Hitchens, you know, religion poisons everything.
Yeah.
I mean, did religion poison Dante and Milton and Raphael and,
mm-hmm,
Michelangelo and Titian? I mean, so much of, mm-hmm, Western literature and culture and painting and art and Baroque architecture is the product of Christianity.
Not to think of Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King and Wilberforce.
And Wilberforce, and exactly.
And a host of others whose great acts of charity and goodness have transformed civilization, and precisely because they thought their views were actually true, you know.
That's right. That's right. But my point is, these guys have just been able to say these things that are preposterous with no challenge
with
at all.
Right.
And so it's more than about time that they be taken on in the public square. My goal over the next year is to have 8 or 9 debates with these leading atheists.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind doing it not in a church setting, but in the university,
no, of course,
on the secular campus.
Right.
You know, preaching to the unconverted, you might say.
Well, good for you. That's where these things need to be done. And you also have a way of talking about these things. I can just tell in the first 20 minutes here of our conversation together that's not laced with religious lingo. That really, I think, stops effective communication. So we champion that kind of thing at Stand to Reason. We stay away from that stuff like the plague, and we want to go out there in the public square and then meet people on their own terms. One possible rejoinder to your observation that, you know, religion's winning is that, as you pointed out, the greatest expansion is happening in the developing countries, where one could argue, listen, this is where people are most superstitious and ignorant. And the educated elite, by contrast, in the Western world, largely secular. So it sounds like a triumph of ignorance over reason. Just counting heads then doesn't do anything in the debate here between atheism and Christianity.
Right, but let's look at, you know, if you look at secularism, the most secular continent in the world is Europe. America is actually more modern than Europe, but less secular. And why did secularism develop so much in Europe? I think the reason it did was the very peculiar circumstances of Europe, in which you may say Christianity was allied with monarchy. If you look at the Enlightenment, people like Voltaire, they were not rebelling against God so much as they were rebelling against what they saw as an oppressive alliance between throne and altar. Now, we never had that in America. In America, when we think of the clergyman, it's not some bishop in a purple robe. It's some local country clergyman who basically worked the farms at one time and so on and is now preaching in a small church that is locally supported. So I think in America, Christianity has stronger roots, and this sort of secularization thesis is peculiar to Europe. You go to Singapore, you go to India, you go to any country in the Muslim world, the smartest people are not less devout than the dumb people.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, my point is, you have religious piety extending throughout the swath of fabric of society.
Mm-hmm.
There's no difference between the educated and the less educated.
Well, if you also, I pointed this out not long ago, if you pick up the history of philosophy, and I'm struggling for the name of the author. He's a Jesuit priest that...
Coppleston.
Yeah. Copleston, right, who debated the great English philosopher of the 20th century.
Russell.
Yeah, Bertrand Russell. And if you read this history, it turns out that from the beginning of the Common Era till about the 17th century or 18th century, virtually every single major thinker of Western civilization that's listed there was a deeply committed biblical theist.
What's interesting is that also applies to the great scientists of Western civilization.
Yes, that's right.
So, you know, when I read, a literary essayist Hitchens or biology major Sam Harris say, oh, there's this irreconcilable conflict between science and Christianity, I'm thinking, well, Galileo didn't see it, and neither did Copernicus and
right,
Boyle
right.
and Gassendi and Leibniz and mm-hmm. Pascal and Newton and Maxwell and Mendel. You can just go down the
sure.
list. All these great scientists
sure.
saw their faith as completely reconciled with
yeah,
their reason.
Yeah, and the value of this observation is not that since we have the greatest thinkers that our views are right, but it seems to point out that it seems unreasonable to say that belief in the Bible and God and Christianity and that whole worldview is somehow irrational and absurd because here's men that were 10 times the thinkers that most of us are, and our whole culture stands upon the shoulders of their intellectual achievements. And so they could have been wrong, but they weren't stupid. You know,
right,
they weren't irrational.
If there was an irreconcilable clash, it would have been apparent to them. I mean, look, Jefferson was a smart man. He realized right away that there is a clash between saying that all men are created equal and owning slaves.
Mm-hmm.
He was well aware of that tension. So there is a tension, and as a smart guy, he knew it.
Mm-hmm.
My point is, if there was a similar tension, don't you think a guy as smart as Newton would have figured it
yeah.
out?
Yeah, this is what happens when people, which happened recently, a Muslim pointed out in Luke, you know, the genealogy in Luke does not match the genealogy in Matthew. And this really upset him, and others have pointed this out, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this problem, but it's a common one. It's a very familiar one for people like me. And I asked him the question, do you think that you guys are the first people in 2,000 years that have ever seen this, that the early Christians didn't see this problem? They realized it wasn't a problem at all. One is the genealogy of Jesus' father or stepfather, and the other one is the genealogy of Jesus' mother. And it's clear when you look down through the details of how that works. And there was a reason for putting them both in there and whatever. But these problems would have surfaced a long time ago if they were really significant. Now, you take did you want to add something?
No, go ahead.
Okay, now, one of the big I look at all these guys and I try to figure out, now, what are the kind of common themes that that they follow to attack Christianity, and you do the same. And one of the themes is we take the side of science over religion, which is a common Enlightenment kind of move, okay? And one of the most powerful evidences for science and against religion from their way of thinking is Darwinism, as Dawkins has said. Darwin has made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, okay? And it seems to me you take an interesting tack on this, and I'd like to talk about it for a few moments, because if people who Christians are going to read this book, they're going to find this out fairly quickly. On the one hand, you seem to give the nod to Darwinism, and what I want to say is writ small. In other words, not the metaphysical elements of Darwinism, but the science that relates to Darwinism. And here we mean macroevolution, not just microevolution. You
right.
seem to be committed to the concept of descent with modification.
Right. In other words, I would go along with evolution, but reject what I would call metaphysical Darwinism.
Right.
By metaphysical Darwinism, I simply mean the atheist spin that is put on Darwinism.
Materialism and naturalism.
Yeah, and we see that in the textbooks as well. It's not just something that's done in the books of the new atheists. We see it creeping into the classroom. So I think the Christians should be fighting very effectively, not so much to teach creationism or even so-called intelligent design. It's much more effective to say, wait a minute, you're not allowed to teach atheism in the biology classroom. That's flatly unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more effective strategy, okay? Now, the point here is...
Wait, help me out here, though. Tell me what that strategy is, because I care about the whole strategic approach here, and I'm not sure I agree with this, so I just
okay.
want to make sure I get it correct. You're saying, and let's just, for the sake of discussion, we both agree that the young earth creationism, I do not think that's a good strategy, because there's too many hoops that people have to jump into.
Okay.
But the intelligent design movement is just looking for an ID, which it turns out has got to be out of the natural system, because the whole thing came into being at some particular point in time, and this implies a creator, and I know you promote that idea there. But at the same, you're suggesting that fighting the Darwinist kind of idea is a bad strategy. Don't even go after Darwinism, dissent with modification, but fight them on a different level. And I'm kind of curious, what is the strategic move? If we give up Darwinism, it seems to me we've largely given up the ship.
I don't think so, and here's why. Well, Darwinism, again, let's talk about evolution for a moment. Here's what I'm getting at. The effort to you may say, wedge in intelligent design and have it taught in the classroom, whatever we think of it, has very poor prospects. I mean, it's been literally flung out of court. There appears to be no receptivity to letting that happen.
Okay, in the classroom, and I agree with that. I'm talking about a general strategy of dealing with the issue in the culture, the ID movement, as opposed to the legal movement of getting it into the classroom. Forget about that. I'm with you on that.
Okay.
And ID guys don't even promote that. The guys over there on the East Coast.
The culture, Greg. Yeah. Here's the point. Right now, we've had for a couple of decades the rather embarrassing sight of Christians who are graduates of Wheaton Theological Seminary taking on biologists from Caltech and Harvard and Yale and trying to debate, could the human eye have evolved, or could the dog and the wolf have a common ancestor? And anyone looking at this debate from the outside, and remember, I'm coming at this largely as a secular guy, begins to think this is absolutely ridiculous. If 99% of all biologists in the world consider evolution to be a fact, are you telling me that some guy who just came out of Wheaton is going to prove the entire biological community wrong? I mean, it's possible, but it's extremely unlikely.
Yeah, but there's another piece to this debate that's being left out, and that is the power of a paradigm, because the metaphysical naturalism that drives these biologists require them to believe in something like Darwinism. It isn't on the merits so much, and I think that can be debated. I'm not convinced on the merits of the facts themselves. I think that these guys believe largely because that's what they're left with, and as you know, there is a tremendous political power that's at play here. They don't have the freedom to defect. You know, they get punished
if
they
even
start.
I agree with all that. I think that, of course, you know, you and I are on the same page. Science does rest on some metaphysical foundations and so on. I agree with all that. But, I mean, can you think in the history of science of another example where the entire biological community in the world agrees to a proposition and are so ignorant of its metaphysical foundations that they are dead wrong about it, but they hang on to it no matter what? Can you give another example?
Well, yeah, I can actually. The idea that science moves along in little fits and starts is not towards more and more accuracy has been demonstrated to be false in itself, and it really moves around by paradigm shifts. Everybody believes one thing, and all of a sudden something else happens, and the whole thing gets changed. It may not be just the biological realm the way you've described it, but it's clear that people hold on to views because they have they have investments in it that go far beyond the statistics. I'm trying to think of, and you probably know them off the tip of my tongue right now. I can't think of the philosopher.
Thomas Kuhn.
Yeah.
The great paradigm shifts did not come about because people simply had wrong assumptions. They came about because there was massive new evidence. I mean, look at, for example, how did the Ptolemaic universe become replaced by the Copernican? Not just that the scientists said, oh, gee, we've got the wrong assumptions here. No, it was that there were massive new discoveries, new telescopes, new measurements, Kepler's
right.
laws, Tycho Brahe, and so
and they,
on.
And you know that when they find out that the universe was not a steady state and we found out that the universe had a beginning, everybody fought it because of the philosophical,
right.
Even Einstein.
Absolutely.
Okay,
so here's my point. My point is the argument from design, which is really what we're trying to defend here,
mm-hmm.
is alive and well at the level of the universe.
Right.
You know, and since that is the case, it seems to me a fruitless expenditure of energy to try to fight it at every retail level.
Okay.
It's like this. It's like if you and I were to see a car, imagine the car to be the universe. We see right away it's designed. We all agree the molecules didn't fly out and assemble themselves. Somebody designed the car.
Mm-hmm.
Along comes young Sam Harris and says, wait a minute, I'm going to prove to you that the life forms, let's call them the wheels of the car, do not require external intervention. They simply operate according to forces that are intrinsic to the car, that are part of the natural functioning of the car.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, so what? How does the evolution of the part refute the intelligent design of the whole?
Yeah, and this is, I think, a very good point that you make in your book, and I think you're quoting someone else here, but the point is, even if we got Dawkins's blind watchmaker, what we don't have a good explanation passion for is the watchmaking factory, and that's a bigger problem to solve.
I mean, look at the original cell. Yeah. More information than the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yes, right.
A circuitry as complex as a computer, and evolution can't explain that. It presumes it.
Okay, so you're saying two things. Just for the record, and I don't want to fight about this much longer because I think, by and large, we're on the same page in the larger picture. But just so people understand, you personally are convinced that descent with modification is established by the scientists, but you don't think that that's an important thing to fight over. You're looking at the bigger picture, and you say, how do we get a world to begin with? And this is the cosmological and somewhat the design argument, the teleological argument, that even allows for something like Darwinian evolution to move forward with descent with modification. And so even if we give them the Darwinism, which you seem to, because you're persuaded that it's legitimate, we still haven't given up the ship because we've got this much bigger argument that we have access to that Darwinism even plays into.
We've given up absolutely nothing, and the ordinary Christian should feel completely secure that evolution in no way threatens his or her faith. Look, the reason I don't like fighting about it is simply this. I mean, it seems to me that if we concede microevolution, I mean, if we concede that within species there is evolution, so that way we're conceding that the Chihuahua on the one hand and the Saint Bernard on the other had a common ancestor.
Right.
So then is it so difficult to believe the dog and the wolf did? The dog and the wolf belong to different species. So what I'm saying is I don't want to fight about that.
Yeah, but there's a difference between whether a dog came from a wolf or they had a common ancestor and whether we had a common ancestor with a banana. You know, that's a bigger step.
No, I agree with that.
Okay, well, that's good. Just for the record, so people who are listening know me, I don't buy the strategy entirely because I'm not willing to give up the descent with modification as a ground of fighting. But that's okay. We both agree on the intelligent design writ large and the universe and all of that. The design argument in general, the kind of thing that you're probably...
By the way, I'm not saying don't argue about it. I'm just saying simply that let's realize that we should not hang our faith on the outcome of this debate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You would agree. You don't want your Christianity to hang where if you turn out to be wrong and there is no paradigm shift and, in fact, evolution is established to be true, will you stop being a Christian?
No.
Exactly.
No, well, I don't. That's true. I won't stop being a Christian, but I mean, when you have counterfactuals, it's always difficult to respond. You know, if you find out that this is the case, I actually don't think the evidence is good, and I think it's moving in the other direction, even with regards to macroevolution. But that's okay. So we have a different strategy on that. Let's move ahead on that because I think the main point that you make there is a good one. What about the watchmaking factory? And we can hang our hat on that. And there's nothing they can do with that. They cannot walk away from that. And this is why Anthony Flew is a theist right now, one of the number one philosophical atheists in the world who's made a change based on that information.
Look at all the intelligence embodied in the laws of nature themselves. I mean, the greatest scientists from Maxwell to Newton to Einstein have spent all this time trying to decode the intelligence out of nature. Mm-hmm. And my point is, who encoded it?
Yeah,
how did that intelligence get there? Is it even reasonable to say that matter just popped into existence or created itself?
It doesn't
make a lot of sense.
No, you're right. We got to go to break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the other attacks that these guys have made. Like, we're bad guys. We're the evil guys. Religion is the big evil, and you've done a good job in speaking to that. And we'll maybe touch on Galileo and some of the other issues, too. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, talking with Dinesh D'Souza on what's so great about Christianity. Talk to you in a moment. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes two DVDs and one data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here, and my guest, Dinesh D'Souza. You probably run into this all the time, huh, Dinesh?
I'm used to it. I've even been called Denise.
Dinesh D'Souza, his book, What's So Great About Christianity, of course, this is one of many that he's written. He is a New York Times bestseller on a book about America and has spent a lot of time in kind of the conservative politics area writing What's So Great About America, Ronald Reagan, How an Ordinary Man Became an Extraordinary Leader, etc. And this, his first book, kind of dealing with more of the religious aspect and expressing a defense for his Christianity in the face of the persistent attacks from the so-called new atheists. And, you know, in a way, Dinesh, this is a pretty bold first move, you know. I know you started out kind of writing in a more general way and then decided to rise to the occasion as these guys started publishing. But, I mean, it's impressive that even though this is your first attempt, you've done a credible job, and I mean, more than credible, obviously. And you're really making a difference with these guys, so that's pretty cool.
Well, the thing is, I come out of the same world that they do, and I've debated, for example, Christopher Hitchens, twice before
on other issues, right?
And so when I saw him up there, and you know, he's had a couple of debates, as you say, he's debated a couple of weakish opponents. He's made them look really bad because he makes incendiary accusations, and then often the other guy just sort of hems and haws or concedes half his point and says, well, but it's complicated on the one hand, on the other hand. Mm-hmm. So I realized, I said, wait a minute, these guys really need, you know, it's good to step in the arena with them and call them on this because
sure.
They're, in a sense, getting away with making the most, and they're not just talking about the Ten Commandments in the public square.
Right,
they're
right.
talking really about the fundamental doctrines
right.
of Christianity. Hitchens makes it seem like God is this evil dictator, sort of like a celestial Kim Jong-il, and that he murderously sacrificed his son. He threatens us with hell if we don't go along with him. He makes God sound like a terribly evil guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
so
well,
I think it's about time we step up to the plate on this.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. We have about 12 minutes, and we've got three topics that I want to touch on. One of is Hume's argument for miracles. The other one is the Galileo story, because both of these are kind of paradigm cases that support a particular way of attacking religion. And miracles are not possible. Science has shown that. Religion is against science. Galileo's an example of that. And then the question of whether religion is evil and Christianity is evil. Can you give a shot? Let's start with Galileo first.
Well, the thing about Galileo is that the modern scholarship on the Galileo case has shown that the most common beliefs that we have about Galileo are the product of an atheist propaganda campaign in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
a campaign totally discredited in academia, but whose reverberations are still felt in the sort of popular, quote, knowledge about Galileo. So many people think the medieval Christians believed the Earth was flat. Then along came the brilliant scientists who showed us that the Earth was round. Total nonsense. In reality, all the medieval Christians, at least the educated ones, knew that the Earth was round. In fact, the ancient Greeks knew that the Earth was round.
See the shadow in the eclipse, for goodness sake.
Yeah, you see the shadow of the Earth. You see when a ship goes over the horizon, the hull and the mast don't go over at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need Galileo's telescopes to know the obvious. So this is a total canard and a myth. Another big myth is Galileo was tortured, and in reality, Galileo was treated like a celebrity. Galileo, when he came to the for his trial to Rome, he lived in the Medici Palace. And when he was eventually sentenced, by the way, sentenced for something that he was completely guilty of, which was lying to the court, he was sentenced to house arrest, and he lived in his very palatial villa in Florence. He was allowed to continue his scientific work. So almost everything that we believe about Galileo is in fact wrong. And so when the atheists used that as a paradigm of the, well, this proves that there's been an ongoing war between science and religion, I show that if you can answer them on Galileo, the whole power paradigm collapses.
Yeah, and you go through the details there. My understanding was a lot what was going on there was the offense was more an Aristotelian cosmology that the Jesuits held to, not a biblical cosmology, and this was the thing that bothered them the most.
Well, the Jesuits were actually right, and what I mean by that is that, look, see, today we know that Galileo was correct, but you have to judge things by the best science of the day. Mm-hmm. And the best scientists of the day were the Jesuit astronomers. Galileo was not an astronomer. He was an optics guy. Mm-hmm. And so he took his knowledge to the Jesuits, and they said, you've made some good points, Galileo, but you haven't clinched your case. Mm-hmm. In fact, looking back, a lot of Galileo's own arguments for heliocentrism were wrong. Mm-hmm. Galileo thought you could prove that the Earth goes around the sun because that's what makes the ocean tides go back and forth.
Right.
But when the Earth moves around the sun, it sloshes around the water in the oceans. Completely wrong. In fact, it's the moon's gravitational force upon the Earth that causes the tides. So here's a guy who was making bad arguments, although in retrospect he turned out to be right. Mm-hmm. But the greatest astronomers of the day, in fact, Tycho Brahe, the great Danish astronomer, did not agree with Galileo and kept a lot of the leading astronomers in Europe from siding with Galileo until after his death.
Mm-hmm. What about, and again, my apologies for jumping so quickly to another topic, but I'm looking at the clock. You made a reference to the issue of miracles and David Hume's famous argument in the late 19th century. And I, how do you reconcile that, or how do you deal with Hume?
Hume's argument is based on a fallacy that, strangely enough, can be discovered by reading Hume himself.
Mm-hmm.
And think about this. A miracle is impossible if what? A miracle is impossible if there is a scientific law that we know has no exceptions. Right?
Hmm.
Now, can you name such a scientific law? Let's take the most obvious scientific laws. Light travels at the speed of 186,000 miles a second. Okay, that's a law. How do we know that? We've measured it. How many times? One time, two times, 10 times, a million times? It doesn't matter how often we've measured it. We do not know, as a matter of fact, that light travels at that speed anywhere and everywhere. Are we sure that on a planet 5 million light years away that light travels at that speed?
It's because this is an inductive argument where you're looking at particulars, and so therefore
exactly.
You never know that there can't be an exception to that, and therefore...
This is Hume's point, that
yes.
No amount of finite observations, however large, can lead to a general statement that is true as a matter of logic.
Mm-hmm.
At best, you can say, on all my previous tries, I have found that light travels at this speed.
Right.
So can I conclude then, for example, let's say someone says, there's a miracle which involves the changing of the speed of light. You can't say that that's impossible because you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point. Miracles are possible if we do not have certain and complete knowledge of scientific laws, mm-hmm. and I'm saying of no scientific law at all is it possible to say we know that there are no exceptions to this rule. Even E equals MC squared.
Mm-hmm. Well, science can't declare that none of its scientific findings are without exception. They aren't capable of doing that, nor can they say anything ultimately about the supernatural. It's like weighing a chicken with a yardstick. You know, it wasn't really designed to do that. Tell me about the attacks here in the last 4 minutes we've got. Just the attacks on Christianity as an immoral religion.
Well, first of all, it's important to realize, you know, I consider myself a reasonably educated guy. If you had asked me a few years ago how many people were killed in the Salem witch trials, I would have said, hey, that's a big blot on American history. I don't know, some thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And if you asked me how many people were killed in the Spanish Inquisition, I would say, well, gee, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of it is when you study this, and there's a big body of scholarship on it,
mm-hmm.
the number of people killed in the Spanish Inquisition was about 2,000. And this is over a period of 350 years.
Mm.
The number of people killed in the Salem witch trials was precisely 18.
18, now, yeah, I knew it was under 20.
Yeah, that's 2018 too many people, I admit.
Right.
But how does this even compare? So, you know, here you've got these atheists, you know, crying crocodile tears over the crimes of Christianity that occurred 500 or 1,000 years ago, and yet they are totally indifferent to the crimes of atheist regimes committed not a long time ago, but in our memory,
in the last century. Yeah.
And these are body counts that begin in the millions, mm-hmm. and in some cases have to be taken into the tens of millions.
Well, by total, I think it's over 100 million if you just think of the three main offenders, Stalin, Lenin, and Mao. Not
and
to take in Pol Pot and all the rest.
Yeah, so it's atheism, not religion, that's responsible for mm-hmm. the mass murders of history.
Now, what do you make of their challenges, though? And I think these are particularly hard for me, regarding the biblical record of slavery, for example, and also the genocide that we see in the scriptures that are not just at the hand of God like the flood, but are the hand of God through the hands of others. And generally it's considered the Jews that are attacking Palestine and taking that land over and killing every man, woman, and child. But you also have the biblical record saying that God sent the Assyrians against the Jews, and that was quite a massacre too. So this is, in our modern mentality, this is like saying, you know, let's fly that plane into the Twin Towers kind of thing.
My way of looking at it is the following. And look, I think honestly that if you're going to focus on the offenses of the Old Testament, I'm going to leave it to the rabbis to answer, because my view is when we look at Christianity, we're taking the Old Testament and the New together. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not repudiating the Old Testament in any way, but I also do think that it's quite clear that there are teachings in the Old Testament that are presented, you may say, tribally. You know, God presents his teachings for his chosen people, and then those precepts are in some ways transformed by Christ, universalized most certainly in the Christian era. So I think that we don't need, as Christians, to ultimately say, listen, we've got to... And also the other thing is the Bible is a narrative, and by a narrative what I mean is it's an unfolding saga
right.
of man's fall, Christ's incarnation, the resurrection, and then the movement towards Christ.
Yeah, the problem for me as a Christian, though, in holding to the Old Testament is that some of the narrative there describes what God commanded the Jews to do in history, and that's the very thing that's in question.
That's right. So, look, I would not admit, I would make this point, and it's a point made actually by the secular Jewish writer Stanley Fish, who, by the way, endorses my book, and he makes this point. He says, these difficulties, the atheists are pointing them out as if they just thought of them. And his point is, if you go back into Christian history, Christians have wrestled with this for centuries and wrestled with it in a far more thoughtful, intelligent, and sophisticated way than anything you find in Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to really deal with these issues, you're much better plunging into Milton, Bunyan, the great Christian thinkers from mm-hmm. Augustine on down.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get a much more powerful way to face these problems and also perhaps to find a way out of them.
Well, I think it's good to keep in mind that in 350 years after the death of Jesus Christ, Christians had pretty much changed the face of the Roman Empire without, first of all, shedding a drop of blood, and secondly, shedding gallons of their own.
And
that might be a good response.
Remember,
yes.
Slavery, which was a defining feature of Greece and Rome, was abolished in the Middle Ages.
Right, right. And it was also, you know, we have Wilberforce there. Listen, Dinesh, it's been great talking to you. It's been a whirlwind hour, and we could. I hope that our paths cross again face to face. We could sit down and have dinner or something, and I hope you do well with your book, and I thank you for taking the tremendous effort to take on these big names with a tremendous assault on the challenges that the new atheists have brought us.
I appreciate it.
All the best to you, Dinesh.
Thank you.
Dinesh D'Souza, the book, What's So Great About Christianity, the publisher, Regnery, and you'll... I encourage you to take a look at it. Now, you know that I've had some reservations about some aspects of it. We talked about that, and that's all right. A lot of good in there as well. So, hour number two coming up. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay with us for Stand to Reason.
I would like to ask you a very important question.
That sounded like Nesh, didn't it? We definitely have to have him on more often. Melinda liked him because he could go toe-to-toe with me, you know, and not lose a step, which was great. I hope you enjoyed that interview, and I certainly did. We look forward to more times with him. Lines open, 1-800-227-5278. We've got 40 minutes of regular airtime here because the Southern California station goes off the air early now for the next 2 months. So just be prepared for that. Those who are in other markets will continue to the top of the hour with you with special programming. So that means if you want to get in the queue, you better do it now or else you're going to miss it. While you're queuing up there with the enforcer, I did want to make a couple of comments. And this is not I'm not blind. I don't mean to be, in a sense, speaking out of turn here. But since I did register my concern about some of the confidence that Dinesh D'Souza offered about Darwinism, and I looked carefully about it at his reasons there, and I went on record saying that I didn't quite agree with that. I didn't want to fight it point for point because we had other things that were really important that I wanted to talk about, and I'm glad we got to some other things. But I did want to give you his five reasons why he believes in descent with modification, and then tell you, just make a comment about each one, why I don't think these are compelling reasons, at least the first four of them. The first reason that he gave, and now again, he's accepting the scientific evidence for descent with modification. That would be macroevolution, the idea that all creatures descended from a common ancestor or something like that. Loosely, there is descent with modification, even if there might have been some miracles along the way. Still, we see this happening, and we have reason to believe that what the biologists themselves almost uniformly say has been the case actually is the case. And so don't fight on that battleground, Dinesh suggests. It's a losing battle, and strategically there's a better way to go. Now, I don't think it's a losing battle, and I do think we give up a lot when we surrender that particular issue. And I don't think on the merits, Darwinism, descent with modification, macroevolution has happened. Now, Dinesh suggested that since microevolution, the small little changes, are demonstrable, this suggests, can't we imagine, macroevolution, changes from one species to another? And that, of course, is the problem. Yes, we can imagine it. Lots of people have imagined it, but imagination isn't science. There are serious problems with that. And even though we could say, well, a dog is a different species than a wolf, they're still dog kind. That's a small move, it seems to me. But whether they're all related to a banana is something else, as one person once put it. His first reason that he gives in his books is that in the early days, many Christians actually endorsed Darwinism. And therefore, since when Darwinism first came out, many Christians endorsed it, we shouldn't be troubled by it as non-Christian. My response is it doesn't matter how many Christians endorsed it. What matters is why they endorsed it. And what does the Bible seem to say about these things? And is this at odds with the Scripture? So it comes down to not a counting of heads, but the reasons. This is the Rhodes Scholar tactic. Secondly, similar point. Consensus of biologists is almost unanimous on this point that biologically, Darwinian evolution in the macroevolution sense, the molecules to man hypothesis basically, I think, to be fair to Dinesh, once you get life, this is the way it progressed. I'm sure he doesn't believe in origin of life by Darwinian means. That's a big problem, he said. In any event, since all these biologists believe at least once you get life, there was a Darwinian mechanism that moved it along, then how could all of these thousands and tens of thousands, millions of biologists be right and a handful of ID scientists be I'm sorry, how could these biologists be wrong and a handful of ID scientists be right? And my point here is that this does not take into consideration the power of a paradigm. If you go into a project as either a naturalist, materialist, philosophically, or at least methodologically a naturalist or materialist, that is, you have to function in your science as if there is no God, then something like Darwinian macroevolution has to be the case. You have no other alternative. That's it.
And so you're going to find the best evidence that you can to support your view. And every time you find something, you're going to say, this affirms what must be the case. And every time you find an anomaly, you throw it out. And this has happened. And so it is not the case, in my view, that the vast majority of biologists believe it on the merits themselves, but because they have, given their philosophical starting point, their a priori's, they have no other choice. And indeed, there's a power structure that will punish them if they change their mind. And there's a new documentary out. I don't know when it's coming out. Maybe you know the Expelled, that documentary with that funny guy in February. Is it coming out? Okay. Well, this documentary identifies the power play that punishes people for breaking ranks with the received tradition of the Darwinian macroevolution. So there is a price to be paid there, and I think that has a profound impact of influencing the numbers. And that's why the numbers, and ultimately the numbers don't matter. It's the arguments that matter. Once again, the Rhodes Scholar tactic. Universality of DNA is the third reason. Every living thing has DNA. Well, this is exactly what you'd predict if evolution were true. And my response is, yes, I can see that, but it's also exactly what you'd predict if intelligent design was true. Do you know that every single vehicle on the freeway, with very few exceptions just recently, every single one, millions upon millions upon millions all over the world for 100 years now, have all had internal combustion engines inside? It isn't because they evolved. It is because the same design was used in each one. So this evidence becomes what's called empirically equivalent with evolution. That is, the evidence counts equally for evolution as it does for intelligent design. This isn't a slam dunk for Darwin. It's equally a slam dunk for a designer then. It's just what you'd expect. So that's a push. Number four is homology. Homology is the idea that living creatures that seem to be related through descent with modification have similar forms. Now, to some degree, this is a trick, because the way things, they know that things that similar forms are related is because they have similar forms. In other words, they have similar body types, and the closer the body types, the more closely we group them in terms of being related in an evolutionary sense. So there's a little circular reasoning going on there. But secondly, wouldn't you expect the designer to use a similar kind of design for similar kinds of creatures? Going back to the car illustration, which we know did not evolve in a biological way. Pretty much every car has four tires. Now, trucks have more than that, but they still have tires bilaterally. And so you have all trucks have these multiple tires bilaterally. So you have a number of different things going on there that are different variations, but they all follow a certain design because the design serves a certain function. So homology, which is another evidence for evolution, is equally, once again, an evidence for design. It works just the same for each explanation. So that's a push. The fifth one is the sequence in the fossil record from simple to complex over time seems so obvious that it can't be disputed. I don't have a good answer for that right now, although I know that except to say that I can give you and show you illustrations of material that I've read where it's clear that this has been, that the facts have been fudged here. Dinesh says in his book that there is no violation of this, but there is. That is, all the fossil records show simple to complex. But there is violation of that, and those violations have been fudged to make it look like they actually follow the standard pattern of evolution from simple to complex. So none of these five reasons that were given in his book why he thinks that Darwinism is acceptable seemed to carry as much weight with me as they had with him. Now, again, I want to emphasize, he's saying, well, why don't we just accept that because the game isn't being played there? We can make more progress in other areas. And on the interview, he seemed to indicate that we weren't being very effective in going after Darwinism. I think this is false. The intelligent design movement has made profound incursions, not just in the design of the universe, which he supports as an argument, but also on the problems of Darwinism itself and macroevolution itself. So just going on record with more information for that, you can judge for yourself when you read the book. Time to go to callers, though, and let's try Brad in Louisville, Kentucky. Brad, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg.
Hey.
Hey, quick question for you. I'm meeting with my sister and her pastor this week to discuss theology and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bounce I wanted to kind of share my game plan with you.
All right.
And get some feedback with you or from you.
Mm-hmm.
This church and my sister are very liberal, very postmodern,
mm-hmm.
Deny absolute truth. And however, what's interesting is they also take a very strong stance on several issues. For instance, they're against a war. They're all for attacking poverty. And I certainly understand their sentiment and where they're coming from. But
mm-hmm.
my first line of reasoning or my first question for him is going to be, so if you're so against war, is war wrong?
Mm-hmm.
I assume he's going to say yes. And then from there, I'm going to go on and say, hey, on what standard do you make this claim
mm-hmm.
that this is wrong or this is bad? Because, and I've kind of shared this with my sister, and when I...
I'm sorry, I missed you there. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You dropped out for a quick second, but go ahead.
Sorry about that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go this route with my sister, she just kind of changes the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I just don't know if he's going to deny truth, but then take these strong moral stances on other things.
Right. Let me suggest something really quickly. If I were you, I would want to get a kind of a commitment from him in principle on his rejection of truth and his challenging of morality. So you might raise a question that has to do with something you know he's already weighed in on.
Okay.
Like it's wrong to judge other people, or we shouldn't be telling other people that we're right about things. And just so, Pastor, so I get your understanding here, and then repeat that, which maybe you've said with him before, you've heard him say before. Is this what I understand? You don't have, and you don't, in your absolute truth, there is no absolute truth. So you kind of get him through these clarification questions, Columbo style. You're getting his rules of the game down first.
Okay.
Before then you apply these rules. And the thing is if you come up with these examples and you start asking him these things, it's going to be a lot harder after he's laid out his rules of engagement, as it were, rules that he feels comfortable in using against you. And this is why I think he'll put them right out there, because they're the very things that he uses to condemn the kind of Christianity that you have. And then now you've got them in place where he's strongly affirmed them, and then you can go
okay.
to these other things. Now, the issue of war is wrong because why? All war is wrong because – and then it's – well, I thought you just told me a few moments ago that it's wrong to make judgments on people.
Okay.
Now, would you consider this a judgment or not? And do you see the advantage of going in that direction as opposed –
oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's like you want him to weigh in a very clear way. But in a sense, it's a set up and destroy, because you are baiting him to say clearly his convictions by offering something that he can that you believe that he can state his convictions clearly against. And then now you've got the rules, his moral rules, and then you could use that. That's the first thing that I suggest. Then with regards to him drifting around to other things like your sister does, this is where I think it's fair to really hold their feet to the fire and in a very gracious way say, now you're getting off on a different topic, and I'm trying to stay on the thing that we've been discussing. You've changed the subject or
okay.
something like that. And just keep pulling them back to the topic.
Okay.
Was there another question there?
No, that was essentially it. It's just so interesting to me because when I anticipate these type of discussions, I can play them out so clearly. But then once you get in the middle of it.
Of course.
It's funny, all the different things. But I know that's the way it goes.
And it's not always tidy, and it's not always tidy for me. So,
sure.
And you've listened to the show enough probably, so you can see it. You know, it doesn't always work out as well for me either. So just do the best you can and give us a call in a few weeks and let us know how it went, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks,
appreciate
Greg.
The call. Bye-bye. Got to go to break. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, back with more of your calls in just a minute. Hi, this is Greg Kokel, letting you know that Stand to Reason is back with an unmatched cruise conference experience featuring some of the top Christian thinkers in the country. On August 2, 2008, we'll set sail from Vancouver, B.C. for 8 days aboard one of Holland America's finest cruise ships. We're planning a voyage you'll never forget. It's specifically designed for those who want to represent Christ to a world looking for answers to life's toughest questions. Here's our plan. We want to challenge you with thoughtful presentations, answer your questions in open forum discussions, and enrich you through interaction and fellowship with expert speakers and fellow passengers. Add to that the stunning splendor of the Alaskan coastline and a 7-day itinerary that includes Glacier Bay, Skagway, Juneau, and Ketchikan. I'll be joined by some of our distinguished guest speakers, Josh McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and Sean McDowell. Come and join Stand to Reason and our lineup of speakers for a memorable spiritual adventure. You'll enjoy plenty of fun and relaxation, along with ample opportunity to meet our speakers, ask questions, and enjoy each other's company. Listen, if studying Christian subjects with some of the sharpest minds on the planet in the fellowship of other believers of kindred spirit aboard a beautiful ship sailing the Alaskan coastline sounds like your idea of a perfect vacation, then this is the trip for you. As always, you don't need any prior understanding of the subject matter. Simply bring a desire to learn in a relaxing environment. We planned everything about this trip with your enjoyment and your enrichment in mind. But don't just take my word for it. Visit STR.org and see what other guests of Stand to Reason have said about past STR cruises. Save the dates, download the brochure from str.org, and then contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours at 800-247-1899. They're helping us with our trip, and their skilled staff are committed to answering all your questions. I look forward to seeing you on board. Back with you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, giving you a piece of my mind today. We're also going to give something else. We're going to give a couple books to our Frapper winners. This would be, now since I've been gone for a week, so we got 2 weeks worth. Kelsey Downing in Lincoln, Nebraska. Congratulations. And Dan Hested at Jackson, Georgia. We're going to be sending Relativism books out to you. And if you would like to receive free books or gifts or something from Stand to Reason, go into our website, go down to our podcast area, and click that, and you'll find a map there. It's called the Frapper Map, and it's the place where you register as a listener, and you let us know that you're out there in the world listening to our show, and those are the names that we draw from to give away free gifts. So Kelsey Downing in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Dan Hestad in Jackson, Georgia, welcome and congratulations. Also, right after the show, I'm going to be heading out to Chino Valley Community Church. I'm going to be speaking out there with Brett Kunkel. At 6:30 to 8:30, and the series is entitled Engaging Culture, Raising Up a New Generation of Culturally Savvy Christians, and Brett and I will both be making our contributions. If you'd like to check it out tonight and you're in that area, it's at 14601 Peyton Drive in Chino Hills. So that would be 14601 Peyton Drive in Chino Hills. You probably can go to our website and punch my face in the lower right-hand corner and then go to my schedule, and the details are there. But it's tonight, 6:30 to 8:30. Hope to see you there. All right, let's go back to the phones, and here we go with Stan in Anaheim, another Southern California.
How you doing, Greg?
How you doing? Good, thanks.
I don't know how to put this. I'm a big-picture kind of guy.
Okay.
So, you know, I want to know the most important things to start with, and then work your way down to the minutia. But in looking at evolution, I'm looking for two things off the top of the bat. I'm looking for a transitional state of anything, mm-hmm. and I'm looking for ongoing evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that most of the scientists believe evolution is true? What's the biggest argument for evolution?
Okay, let me give you – there are two answers to this, and I'm going to move quickly because we got a shortened show here. The first one is a metaphysical argument. The other one is a scientific argument, and here I use the word scientific in terms of methodology. In other words, the facts and details of science. Those two issues are usually are mixed in together inextricably, and you have to work hard to keep them apart. But scientists go into their enterprise with a naturalistic metaphysic, that is, their view that the only thing that exists is nature and material things, materialism. And if they don't hold that strictly as a total worldview, they hold that as they do their science, and that's what the term methodological naturalism means. So when they go in to do their biology, they assume that there is nothing outside of the physical realm operating in a cause and effect way with natural laws that accounts for anything happening in the world, and they are not allowed to think otherwise. And so what I said earlier is that if this is the way you start, if you artificially, metaphysically, or operationally, methodologically leave out any possibility of intelligent design, well, then something like Darwinian evolution has got to be true. So they are, in a certain sense, they are tainted from the beginning in a way that scientists of an earlier age were not. They are not free to follow the evidence wherever it leads. They are free to follow the evidence to give them certain kinds of answers, materialist, naturalistic answers, and that's it. And that's what they mean when they say that intelligent design, creationism of any sort, is not science, because it comes to the wrong kinds of conclusions, principally. So that's the that is the biggest problem. They're not allowed to look elsewhere. Now, with having said that, I can cite, as I did a few moments ago, some of the reasons that they think that evolution actually took place. Now, this is evolution in the Darwinian sense. For one, they can see what's called microevolution, small changes that are chosen of in favor of by natural selection that allows those genes to get into the next generation. So you find that some people might have a genetic predisposition to overcome a disease, and when the disease hits the land, it kills everybody without it, and those who survive reproduce themselves with that immunity, and they survive then, and they're not hurt by the disease. Now, that's a natural selection.
Okay, but...
And the people see the microevolution, and they think, as D'Souza mentioned, you can imagine how if you keep doing this, you can get other things over the long haul. And yes, you can imagine that, but does the science show that the genes are that flexible? I think the answer is no. But you're asked why would they believe it, and that's one of the reasons they believe it. They think that microevolution, which can be seen, implies macroevolution, which they think they see in the fossil record, but certainly you can't see now because it takes too long to produce.
But I see no evidence for macroevolution. Is that a correct statement?
Well, what you'd have, they think they see the evidence in the fossil record. And so what you'd have to demonstrate is that microevolution in the details of the biology can't get you macroevolution. It's not an adequate kind of mechanism. Natural selection can only take you so far because the gene pool has a limited amount of information. The only way you can get further changes in anything that's really significant and unique is if the gene pool changes. You have an infusion of information. That might happen in some degree with mutations, but mutations doesn't give it the right kind of information to make the thing a better thing from a survival perspective.
Wow, so, what a bag.
Yeah, so those are some of the problems. And I homology is a big thing, that things look alike, that things that are similar look alike. Monkeys and human beings have similar body styles, and so these are ways that people have argued, and that this is compelling, but I think that these have answers from an intelligent design perspective. The big problem is the micro to macro jump. The biology can't accomplish that.
It takes more faith than I have.
Well, I agree with you. This is one of the reasons that I'm not an evolutionist.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Stan, nice talking to you. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Carl. Is that right?
Yes.
La Mesa.
Hello, Greg.
How are you doing?
Okay. In many an evangelistic presentation, they don't even read a Bible verse. They just read a piece of a Bible verse, Isaiah 64:6. The idea is saying to the unsaved person, see, all your righteous acts are like filthy rags, and here it says it right here in the Bible, see. Is that really legitimate to use in an evangelistic presentation, do you think?
Well, I think it's legitimate to use verses or pieces of verses if what one has done beforehand is he makes sure that he is not just seizing the verse out of its context, but the understanding that he has of the verse is either supported by the context or not disqualified by the context. All right. Now, I'm not, you know, I'm looking at, I've read Isaiah 64 a number of times before. This particular passage seems to me to be fairly straightforward, and unless somebody's going to show me something different, I don't know if you've read it, it seems a straightforward characterization that is consistent with other pieces of Scripture, what God, how our goodness compares to God's holiness. And the verse reads this way, "For all of us have become like one who is unclean. All our righteous deeds are like filthy garments." Now that's a comparison. "And all of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind carries us away." And I think the point of this passage is to show that even though we think we're well-dressed in our goodness, there is a comparison of our goodness to something else that makes it look like, well, in this sanitized translation, filthy garments, but the original translation means bloody menstrual rags. That's what the Hebrew suggests. What the writer is trying to show us is we have nothing good that impresses God, and that the real problem is that we have iniquities that carry us away. The best that we can do is not enough to carry out or to cancel out the force of the iniquities and the sins in our life. And I think the language is especially compelling because it says, all of us wither like a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind take us away. And so you see a pile of leaves there that are utterly defenseless against the wind that blows them hither, thither, and yon. And in the same way, we try to do all these righteous things, and what it amounts to is just filthy, dirty rags. And the thing that annihilates us is our own wickedness, which we cannot stand against. So I have no reason to believe that this verse means anything more or less than what we've just described. Have you read more of the chapter that makes you wonder?
Considering about verses 10 and 11 here, your holy cities have become a wilderness, Zion has become a wilderness, Jerusalem a desolation, our holy and beautiful house where our fathers praised you has been burned by fire, and all our precious things have become a ruin. It seems to be specifically talking about the nation Israel there and in a certain situation after the exile.
Yeah, well, that's true. But would you, are you suggesting that you think the author is not talking about himself as a human being in verse 6 there, but he's talking about himself simply as a Jew?
Well, it could be. I don't know from the context.
Yeah.
I'm also concerned about, you know, how does this contradict Acts chapter 10, where it appears that Cornelius's some of his righteous deeds were not considered filthy rags by God there.
Right. Well, I think that and others are called righteous, and so there is the way I respond to that kind of thing is I say sometimes there is a righteousness that can be called righteousness in a proper kind of comparison. So here is a man who's living righteously after a fashion, after one way of measuring it, and he has appealed to God. Now, it's clear that he's not righteous enough. And the reason it's clear is because he required the gospel for his sins to be forgiven. So he is a guilty man under condemnation, as a matter of fact, even though there are things that he has done that God has responded to. Romans chapter 3 later on says that there is none righteous, that there is none even one. There's none who does good, not even one. And so I think what we have is we have different passages on the one hand that identify in the ultimate what man's righteousness looks like. And I think Isaiah 64 and Romans 3 are examples of that. But other times we see kind of a comparative sense of righteousness, some men compared to other men, and they do live more righteous lives on that basis, but in no way does it suggest that we could, our righteousness are going to commend us before God, because even in the case that you identified in Acts chapter 10, Cornelius, he still needed that message of salvation and forgiveness of sins that God arranged Peter to bring to him. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay, great. Appreciate. Okay. Yeah, thanks for the call, Carl. And sometimes those are tricky issues. I can appreciate that. Why don't we go to break right now, if that's all right, and then we'll come back to it looks like Santa Claus, but it's Santa Clarita, California, and Steve and his question. And more Stand to Reason after this message.
We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800-2-REASON.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
If ever I would leave you, it wouldn't be in summer. Seeing you in summer, I never.
Now, this is from one of my favorite musicals of all time, and this is Robert Goulet, apparently. He just died just a couple days ago, so this is in honor of him. But this is the song from Lancelot. I thought he played King Arthur. He didn't. He played Lancelot. Okay. Oh, Richard Burton played King Arthur. All right. Well, that makes more sense. Okay, let's go quickly here in our final segment to Steve in Santa Clarita, California. Hi, Steve. Good, thanks. What's
up? Well, quick question for you. I'll try to make it clear as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Does God react to our prayers? In other words, for example, in our church, we have a group that's a family that went to Mexico as missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
We just heard that they're having a hard time, their marriage is in trouble, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the group in our church got together to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does God respond to that prayer? In other words, if we had chosen instead to go out to dinner and a movie, would he not respond and work in their lives? Or,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. The answer to that is yes. We have every reason to believe that God, that prayer makes a difference. Now, we have that from scriptural statements. You have not because you ask not. Ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door shall be open. These are just a couple of verses came right to the top of my head. So the injunction of Scripture is that we are to go to God and make request of Him, and God will respond in virtue of that request. And that when we don't go to Him and don't ask, then there are things that He would have responded to had we asked, and He isn't responding because we didn't ask.
So we have a hand in how things are accomplished in our
yes.
lives. In other words, I'm coming from a buddy of mine who's what I would call a strict Calvinist, and he says that, you know, all these things are predetermined, and the prayers that we pray are only because we're told to pray. and not because we have a real effect on anything.
Well, then this is where sometimes Calvinistic people, I think, are not careful in the way they describe what Calvinism actually teaches. Calvinism doesn't teach determinism, strict determinism. Strict determinism, in that, if that's what it taught, then God would be responsible for evil, that God directly causes every single thing to happen. There is no choice of any kind. And if you look at the Reformed Divines, for example, the Westminster Catechism or the Westminster Divines, the Council of Dort, you know, these are Reformed kind of confessions where they say that God works and ordains, and I think the word that they usually use is not that he determines, but that he decrees and that he ordains in a way that does not violate individual free will. Now, there's some question as to what free will is in that circumstance, and that's where a significant part of the debate is. But it is clear from the scripture where your friend is getting his so-called determinism about God that the very same scripture says you have not because you ask not. Now, there is a sense in which God's designs and God's decrees are accomplished in a very complicated way that we do not know, that secures his particular ends while at the same time allowing for our free action.
Right.
And he says that, you know, simply put, we have not. So not only from individual experience do we see that God answers and responds to prayer, but also from scriptural statements and injunctions that God answers and responds to prayer. And it's not just when we're told to pray, but when we see the specific prayers that are prayed by people that God responds to. So I think that your Calvinist friend is mischaracterizing Calvinism at that particular point, and he's misunderstanding.
Okay. Now, in regards to, for example, when Nineveh repented, or when I forget the name of the king, but he repented and was given extra life. You know,
right,
longer.
Right. Hezekiah
is
or something.
Is that God reacting? In other words, what I'm trying to get my mind around is, did God say, okay, because they did that, now I'm going this direction?
Yes, that's the way I would characterize it. I would say that God did. It isn't like God said, oh, here's a new detail. Man, I was mistaken before. Oh, okay, I think I'll do something different now. Or, you know, when he changes his mind, he has a fixed attitude with regards to one set of circumstances and a fixed attitude with regards to a second set of circumstances. And when the second set of circumstances obtain, that new attitude then is expressed there. So I think that's the best way to understand.
And in either direction he ends up going, it's still in line with his greater will.
Absolutely.
And goal for the world.
And keep in mind, it isn't like he's surprised when somebody repents. God
right.
doesn't learn anything in those cases.
Right.
He always knows the way it's going to go. All right, I got to run to another call.
Okay.
Yes, thanks, Steve, for the call. Let's go to Paula. And Paula in Missouri, welcome to Stand to Reason. We've got about 3 minutes, but we can get your question.
Hi, Greg. Thank
Hi
you
there.
So much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. It's about a friend of mine who is an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
He believes that God is immoral and that Christians that believe in him are immoral because of the way he's gone about saving humanity.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, the idea of a blood atonement, he thinks that's very immoral, that an innocent Jesus would have to die on a cross for crimes that he'd never committed,
mm-hmm.
being as that he's completely innocent, and that we kind of exploit that.
Yeah, well, it might be immoral if he was forced against his will to do something like that to pay for somebody else's crime. But let's say, what's your friend's name, first name?
Joe.
So you say, Joe, what if you were really poor and then you got a traffic ticket and you couldn't pay it and they were going to impound your car? And I said, well, I'll pay it. Would you say that's immoral? Or would you say that's an act of kindness? Now, my suspicion is that Joe would consider it an act of kindness because you were not guilty, but you suffered in the sense of making payment for a crime that he committed to rescue him from the consequence of that crime. And that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. Jesus said, nobody has taken my life from me, but I give it up on my own accord. And keep in mind, Christians, since this is an attack on Christianity, Christians actually believe that Jesus was God. God is the judge here, but he is also the one who takes the punishment on behalf of the one who is guilty.
Right.
So it is a great act of love for the judge to step down and take the judgment that he decrees justly against us, and he takes that penalty upon himself in order that we might go free.
Okay. How about when you take it from the angle that, because I've talked to him about this a lot, and he says, why would God set up that kind of a catch-22 to begin with?
It's not.
Why couldn't he, do you know what I'm saying, as far as opposed to, say there was a sinning humanity that wanted to be sorry and repent,
okay,
why
well,
do we have to go through the whole
blood atonement thing?
Why did God create that?
Two thoughts. It's not that God just arbitrarily decided this. God is a being with perfect holiness, so he is perfectly good, and he is perfectly just. Now, I suspect that your friend would consider both goodness and justice to be virtues. So both of these are offended by our actions. So it is because of us that God has then responded to provide a way where justice can be satisfied, and he, through goodness, can offer mercy to us. Now, so that's one aspect of it. I don't think there's anything unusual or strange about that at all. And in fact, you could probably give examples from your own life to demonstrate these kinds of things. I just gave those illustrations. But secondly, it isn't like he can opt out of this. It isn't like he say, well, I don't like that. You know, I wish it didn't have to be this way, so I'm just, and I didn't ask to be born, so I'm just going to opt out. This may be the way reality is. You know, why did gravity have to be such that it, if you fall, you step off a high ledge, you die? Well, I don't, you know, maybe it could have been different, but the world we live in is like that. So
right.
Don't step off of high buildings. So there's a kind of a sense in which you want to do two things. You want to try to explain him the sensibility of this, and that just like you doing this great act of grace and kindness to him by paying for this penalty that took from you, even though you were guiltless, but you did it because of caring for him, God has done the same thing for him with regards to his own crimes. And secondly, if he doesn't like the system, just because he doesn't like the system doesn't mean he can just opt out of the system, you know, like, all right, I'm gonna go with some other system.
Right.
You know, if this is in fact the way the world is, if we can demonstrate that God is real and that Jesus walked this earth and did certain things and rose from the dead and whatever, all of these things, if we have good reason to believe this is the case, then, you know, even if there are some things that maybe you and I don't even like about it, it doesn't mean we can change those or opt out just because it doesn't fit our fancy. And that's the bigger thing that he's got to deal with. I mean, even for an atheist to say that God's actions were immoral implies that he believes in morality, but how is he going to find morality without a God? I mean, how is he going to make sense of morality without God? So that's another problem that he has to deal with. Paula, I hope that helps. Sorry about the short shrift here. We're all out of this segment. We're going to have to say goodbye to our L.A. audience and Southern California audience. For those of you on the rest of the network, stay tuned for more of Stand to Reason.